Hi and welcome to What's Next. I'm Therese, your host, and I was trained to be an architect. I work as an architect, and I started this podcast to talk about what's next in the fields of architecture, design, and technology. Facing topics such as climate change, artificial intelligence, and where humanity's place is in this fast-moving world. I hope you enjoy this week's episode, so have fun listening.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for being my guests. How are you?
Very good. Very, very good. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thanks very much, Tres.
It's a pleasure. So, first question, who are you? Please introduce yourself and your studio.
Hi, everyone. My name is James McConville, and I'm a director at a social enterprise called Accelerate and Change Together, or ACT. And we are based in Ireland.
Yep. And I'm Tom Lindsay, also another director at ACT.
Okay. And what do you do?
Everything.
What's the studio doing? Everything?
No, I'll hand over to James. He's got a little clearer
way to explain. I guess we set up ACT as a social enterprise, and we're a mixture of architects, urbanists, and policy specialists. And our kind of sole social mission is to accelerate the green transition on the island of Ireland. So our kind of vision is an Ireland that is carbon negative, ecologically thriving, and like socially inclusive. And we try and do this through implementing sustainable development, and trying to inspire change at a community level, and most importantly, trying to design a beautiful future. Because if it's not aspirational, then it's going to be very difficult to bring people on board on that journey.
Mm-hmm. So you're on a social mission. That sounds really great. But before we dive deeper in your social mission, we have some warm-up questions. And the first one would be, what's your favorite drink? Alcoholic, non-alcoholic?
I mean, this is the most difficult question, but I think I'm going to have to go for a really plain, boring one, which is Guinness, because as you can tell from my accent, I'm English, but we do almost all our work in Ireland. So I'm over a lot, and James and Kevin, our other director, have introduced me to why Guinness is so much better in Ireland compared to everywhere else.
Yeah, it doesn't travel well, so it's, yeah, you have to get it locally. I'd probably say Guinness. It's always in the context as well. Like, you know, if you're after lots of exercise or something, yeah, maybe it might be a nice lager. But yeah, Guinness, I think, is a base staple.
Okay, so Guinness works for the both of you. Yeah. So you're super easy guests.
If you have Guinness, yeah.
If you could develop a skill overnight, what would you wish for? It can be anything. And in my opinion, this is the most difficult question.
So I took a lot of time to think about this. James and I were discussing it before our call. And then James got fed up with me and said, Tom, why not you choose spontaneity? And actually, I think that's a pretty good choice for me. And actually is one of the reasons why James and I work really well together. I take a long time to make decisions, bit of a perfectionist, and James gets things done. So I'd like a little
not always well though, but we scattergun, you know, one of those five ideas is a germ of a good idea. Maybe for me, randomly, maybe like I would love to learn Portuguese. I've learned other languages, but I just love the sound of Portuguese. If I could pick that up overnight, that would be great.
So from everything that you can choose, like flying or being invisible, time traveling, you choose learning Portuguese and becoming a teacher. Okay.
But to flip the interview back on its head, what is yours? You've asked this question multiple times. What do you pick?
I couldn't decide yet. I would like to do probably time traveling.
I think it sounds like you need spontaneity as well. Because, you need to be a doer to do any of these things, time traveling or anything.
What's your favorite hobby besides architecture?
For me, I guess anything that's got a board. So I'm a big, like, I think what drew me into architecture was I was a big skateboarder growing up. But now, as ACT is based on the west of Ireland, it's surfing. So surfing good waves. Like I managed to do this morning, actually. It's quite nice before work.
Yeah, same for me. It's actually a really nice thing to be able to do this, go for a really early surf session in the morning and then start work because it's, 10 minutes away from the office?
Yeah.
Amazing to have a hobby like that so close.
So what time do you get up in the morning then?
Well, that makes it sound like I do
and
that.
When do you start to work?
I have. You start at a normal time, like 9 o'clock, but I currently have an 8-month-year-old, so my start time could start between 5 or 6 a.m. or even 4 if he's feeling up for it. Shout out to a little Adam.
Okay, great. Then you mentioned you're on a social mission. How does that look like? Do you propose competitions or how do you start if you're on a social mission?
It might not necessarily be it's a social mission, but I think when I'm talking about a social enterprise, in Ireland, you have different ways to form a company. And we're a company limited by guarantee, which might sound a bit like over technical, but it means there's no shareholder in a company. So all the profits we deem as surpluses and they're reinvented into the company, whose social mission is to accelerate Ireland's green transition. So the idea is we decided to set up ACT, and I might kind of get into a bit of the story of why we decided to set up a social enterprise as opposed to like a limited company as most architecture firms are set up as. But it was to try and almost put a stake or a line in the ground or a line in the sand that we want to focus on sustainable regenerative design, but we're going to put it into the DNA of why we structured our company. And we're held to that as our yardstick. So when people come to work with ACT, they're coming for that service particularly.
Do you have an example?
An example, I guess, maybe in the kind of type of work that we do. We work at 3 scales, and maybe I'll let Tom talk to the third bucket, but we have 3 main buckets of work, which is on a local level, architecture and urbanism. So that could range from, we're currently working on multi-generational town center living projects, multi-sensory park project. We're also working on a vision and strategy level. That's our second bucket. So we're working with doing community stewardship plans for sand dune ecosystems. We're also working on a project where it's looking at the architectural curriculum in Ireland and how it could help be transitioned to a resilient design curricula. And then our third bucket, which we term as at scale, is where we look at really where Tom's expertise comes in, is the tools and policy. And I should also mention that ACT is 3 founding directors, and one of our directors, Kevin, he brings a kind of the design edge to ACT. He worked previously for large architect practices like MVRDV, and his contribution to ACT is bringing a design process and rigor to what we're doing under our social mission as well.
Mm-hmm. So Tom, you're not actually an architect? You studied something different, or where comes the knowledge from?
Well, no, I studied. So actually the reason James and I know each other is we studied our undergraduate together, and I did go on to study architecture in my master's. But I kind of fell out of love with the profession, not with architecture necessarily, and got really disheartened by it. So actually, I've spent the last 10 years in working in sustainable urban development across the world in mainly like philanthropy or not-for-profits. And for me, it's often been in like the policy world or working with local authorities. And so policy is what I've seen and what I speak now. There's often not a lot of doing in policy, which is what disheartened me. And then when meeting James again and Kevin a couple of years ago to set up ACT, they were coming from the other side of the spectrum, which is they working in architecture practices, and they knew that there was a better way of doing things, a more sustainable maybe more beautiful as well way to do things. Whereas I was coming from this thing of, I wanted to see things built. I wanted action to actually happen as well. So we decided to meet in the middle. And just to mention about that third bucket, the at scale work. I mean, I think that is, I guess, my realm, but that's what I find really exciting is we can do all of this great work, all this great project work. And I think many firms will do this as well. But that at scale thing responds to the point that whatever change we're making needs to kind of be at the same scale and pace as the challenge itself. So that could be tools and services. So we develop software around helping architects, but also other sustainability leads and different organizations become or make better sustainable decisions. But we're also working with the architecture schools, so all architecture schools across Ireland, to help reform their curriculums around making them more about resilience and sustainable development. And I think had I seen all those years ago that reform or knew that things were going to change in such an exciting way, I probably would have stayed in architecture. But it's just an amazing thing to be able to punch above our weight and contribute to that reform.
And what means sustainable for you? Because for me, sustainability is just like a commercial sign, and actually there's nothing behind. So what does it mean for you?
That means you're going to have to be much more positive about it. But I, you know, you are right, of course, to some extent. I think without knowing what it actually means, then often all we do is, we stamp that very nice sign of sustainability on our things, but we don't know what it is. For us at ACT, yes, it's about climate, but it's about getting over this thing of climate or carbon tunnel vision, which is this thing of, if you are going to focus on becoming more sustainable, we often talk about energy consumption or carbon emissions, all really important things to consider. But sustainability itself is, and this is in the world of sustainable development, it's quite well known already, it means more than just climate action. It actually means understanding what your impact is. So a lot of the time at ACT, we work on the theme of impact on our work. And impact can be environmental or should be environmental, social, economic, even political sometimes as well. And so from even the outset of our work, we consider those realms and design to those benefits or ideas of what impact is.
Yeah. And when you have a new project, how does your design process look like? Do you have a set of rules that you stick to, or all the three of you come together, talk, or everybody sits locked up in their separate room making some opinions for themselves and then get back together, or how does it start?
I think maybe flip it a wee bit. We don't see it as rules, more like a responsibility. And personally for me, maybe to backtrack a tiny bit there. So Tom was coming from policy background and seeing the blockages to get to a green transition in the policy world, and Kevin and myself, we were working in the architecture at the kind of the coal face, let's say, more ways than one, delivering the architecture that's being informed by the policy, and we were seeing similar blockages, and the idea of sustainability, especially for architecture, was like, there's, you know, operational carbon, and there's capital carbon, you know, the actual building as well. And originally the whole thing was, let's stick loads of solar panels on the roof, let's increase insulation. And it's like, well, that's grand. Okay, that works to one extent. But then what's the building made out of? You know, it's the next stage. And now we're all going, oh, Jesus, now we need to make everything out of timber and sequester carbon. I would even argue there's one step before that, where it's the brief. It's like, is this appropriate to do this? And I think architects are struggling at that stage, and that's where sustainable development and sustainable development goals kind of act for us as our North Star, because the sustainable development goals are 17 goals of what kind of sustainable development looks like. They're not perfect, but they're designed, or they've been agreed by virtually all countries on the face of the earth, and under them sit 169 sustainable development goal targets, which get into the specifics of how we actually achieve that. So it's trying for architects to be aware of this framework out there. So take, for example, we work with a school project, for example. You could have an A-graded school in the wrong place, which is placed outside of town, which facilitates more car dependency, locks in carbon for an additional another 30 years because everyone's going to have to travel back and forth. But because we don't, the architect's profession currently now is just looking maybe at the operational carbon of the building and the construction cost, the embodied carbon, it's trying to get to that next level. And this is where policy ties in. It's like, should we actually be doing this project this way, or should we change the brief? And most of the big carbon decisions or any impact decisions are made in the first like 4 to 6 weeks of a project. So it's trying to work out maybe in our design process how we get in as early as possible to help bring this rigor of sustainable development thinking into a project, to critique it when people are deciding floor areas or deciding the actual program. And maybe the role of an architect might be to say, I don't think this building needs to get built, because we could utilize other areas and other parts of a building to actually achieve this. So that's kind of maybe in a roundabout way of trying to how we're talking about our design process. So we have a methodology which we use, is called the Double Diamond design methodology, and that was developed by the British Council, I think it was almost 20 years ago. But it's the idea of expansive thinking and then convergent thinking. So you arrive at a project, look at what's there as objective as possible. Don't come with any preconceived, you know, I want to draw this thing on this site. That's not the ACT process of how we work. We look at it and say, well, what does the site constraints and opportunities already exist on the site? What is the brief? How does that tie into policy? Like, kind of arrive at the project beautifully naive and then understand it through our process of expansive thinking to devise some project objectives, conclusions that then feed into objectives, which then those objectives steer the design. And then there's a rigor that's the kind of, you know, multiple iterations of design, which then leads to the kind of the middle piece between the diamond, if you can imagine in your head, two diamonds, but where those two diamonds converge is then that's the chosen kind of option that we then pursue and develop further. So that's kind of our way of approaching it.
And what brought you to finding that studio? You were working as an architect, and then you found each other again and you had this idea. And what inspired you to find the studio?
I think, as Tom was saying before, and Tom, I'll let you jump in after. I know for myself and Kevin, the other director, I think it was a mixture of inspired, but also, I'll be honest, quite fear. Because seeing how design is being delivered and seeing, you know, you'd only have to open up your phone and look at any news. We even have, like, on news sites now, a topic called the climate crisis. Like, we know that that's here. And it's how do the, like, it behoves us when we have like maybe 35% of the carbon emissions on just what the buildings are built out of and the operational carbon, like what we're doing in terms of as our the AEC sector for it. So we kind of felt in a kind of way that I didn't want to be at least contributing to that. I want to at least be able to, in some ways, maybe a bit grandiose, look at my son in the eyes and when he's older and think that at least I was trying to do something in a positive way instead of business as usual, which is producing concrete, heavy carbon buildings in the wrong place, wrong scale, not designed with circularity in mind, not thinking about potential synergies with other buildings around. You know, I'm not saying all buildings are doing that, and there are some fantastic architecture practices out there leading the charge on that, but I thought that I wouldn't be able to achieve that in as quickly within a big architecture firm, and realized that that would take years to even get up into a seniority position to even maybe affect briefs. So with Tom and Kevin, when we were all were talking about kind of, you know, the having the beer and discussing the problems of the world kind of way, like, thought it would be more, it could be more advantageous to actually just set up ourselves and just put our stake down. And I know Tom, me and Kevin were coming from an architectural perspective. I was working in Sweden at the time and seeing kind of best practice over there. But even from a Swedish perspective, like I was designing nursery schools, and like the technical guidance documents, the standard way of designing a nursery, they had defined in the policy document it should be timber because it sequesters carbon. I did three of these projects, and in every first meeting, the first thing we did was make the walls thicker, or make them thinner, sorry, and make it out of concrete and steel, and put some timber on the front. And
really?
You immediately have just done 60% of your carbon is in your structure. So you've immediately moved, and that happened day one, you know. So really any other sustainable move I make after that project goes down the road is so negligible, as opposed to the first move at the start. And because the architect, I'm not saying all architects, but because we don't have the agency that maybe we once had, we just go, okay, yep, that becomes steel and concrete, that's fine. But I wanted to be in a practice where at least we could say no, or we wouldn't be working on projects like that. We'd be trying to show best practice examples in a positive way. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do at ACT is show positive solutions. It's not necessarily to critique and say, oh, everybody's bad and we're great. It's not like that. And I don't think that's helpful to what we have to do. We all have to collaborate. And that's where the Accelerate Change Together part comes in, because we want to try and show projects that can be hopefully seen as best practice examples that can inspire others to change on an architectural level. And I know I've been talking a lot, Tom, but maybe bring you in from maybe a policy perspective as well. Like why?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think James actually did cover a lot of the reasons as to why we set this up. From a policy point of view, I think just before doing this, I was working on a lot of national policy around how economic growth not only should be or could be sustainable, actually it needs to be for itself to be sustainable. Anyway, it's very wishy-washy level of work. And if anyone's worked on that level, it's very difficult to see the impact, which is what we're interested in, what James has been talking about. And without seeing impacts, you know, why leave the world of philanthropy and not-for-profits if I wanted to see impact, right? But actually, you can still feel very disconnected from the change that you're supposedly enacting. And I think actually from, you know, in a post-COVID world, or I've seen a lot of friends and others who have just dropped out of what they all changed or suddenly realized that what they're doing isn't what they want to do anymore. And I think a lot of it is to do with purpose. And I've seen that across not just architecture, a lot in architecture, sure, but I was talking to a friend who works in film, you know, on big movies, and even she gets it at times. And you think, wow, you're doing all this amazing thing with film stars, etc. And even you get disheartened because things can seem really purposeless. So building something that is mission-led like ours, but also just building something full stop that is your own and has something where you can put the direction in and you know everything you're doing has a purpose, it just makes like every day really enjoyable. And it's important because you've got to do that. So, you know, you have yourself have to be kind of sustainable to deliver any of this sustainability that we're talking about.
And I think one other wee aspect, because I appreciate it got a bit heavy talking about, you know, the big picture thing, it's so much fun. Mm. Like you mentioned, how do you find time to go surfing before work? It's like, because we set it up that we prioritize a work-life balance, which is about, you know, you need to feel good to work to the best of your, you know, abilities. And I've had the best fun, professional fun in the past, my whole career in the past 2 years, setting this up with Tom and Kevin and now the rest of our team, which is coming on board. Shout out to Ina, Rebecca, Simone, you know, who have been working with us. And yeah, it's been a really, really great ride doing it as well. So it's not all kind of, you know, grim, you know, that, you know, just because the numbers don't look so good at the moment for humanity. Like we want to inspire change at a community level and we want to design a beautiful future. And the great thing is if we actually design, and I wouldn't even say sustainability is our baseline, it needs to be regenerative is where we need to be going, because we've done a lot of damage. You know, we can't just be, sustainability is almost like being agnostic to the situation, do no bad, no, do no good. we need to be doing good. We need to be getting to regenerative, like repairing the earth, repairing the soil, you know, being, having carbon, I always get this mixed up, carbon negative buildings, you know, sucks more carbon out of the earth or air than, you know, we just put out. So it, but it actually creates beautiful architecture as well. Like, because you find by prioritizing nature and prioritizing people, you get a lot more activated spaces. You get a lot more interesting solutions than, you know, big steel, you know, framed buildings with a big car park at the front. And it's all just, you know, quite dark and gray. And, you know, we just prioritize the motor car over everything. And, you know, it's, you know, that's not a very exciting future. But actually, when you, you know, think in a different way and look and prioritize people, active travel, do you know what I mean? Maybe mm-hmm. multifunctional spaces that can be used in the evenings, you know, you get more interesting briefs, you get more interesting architecture, you get, it's more beautiful as well. So it's like a win-win. And I think the really exciting thing that's happening right now on a corporate level as well is it's actually a lot more profitable. There's even this concept, the whole idea of stranded assets, where big like investment firms are seeing these big, you know, 50, you know, 100 story like office blocks that they've built in far-flung places, as these assets won't, they're trying to get them off the books because they're not going to be viable in, you know, 10, 20, 30 years time. And this is, you know, it's big picture thinking, but like, you know, we're doing the small scale architecture at the local level, and that's why we're working at global and local levels with the policy and the architecture. But it's really interesting to think about your work in those two scales simultaneously, because you get both interesting outputs in both as well. So yeah, that's.
So with what materials do you work then? Do you have suggestions?
One of the projects that we're working with now is looking at, it's a multi-generational town center living. And the concept at least has been to use straw bale construction, mm-hmm. which is the idea of using, it's almost like box frames that you stack together like Lego blocks, but the straw is actually pressurized in and pushed into the actual box, and it's so tight that air can't get in, so it can't burn, so it gets 120 minute fire rating. So oh, really? You know, I don't know if you know the story in Germany, you know, the three little pigs story. It's fake news, you know. you can actually create buildings that are you know, out of straw, and it's very light. Because one of the maybe the interesting things about, and I think rightfully, the move now to timber as a opportunity sequester is, when you actually look at the amount of forest we have and moving towards maybe cross-laminated timber like CLT, it's a very heavy building and it uses a lot of trees. And if you did, it will need a lot of forest for those. So one of the opportunities of using straw bale construction, especially on medium-rise buildings, is it only uses, I think I'm quoting here, one of the kind of brochures on the company we were using, it's like 6% or 7% the amount of timber required for their methodology versus like a CLT panel. That's the same. The CLT panel might be appropriate in some buildings and contexts, but there are really interesting solutions out there and a lot more local as well. For Ireland, especially as an island, you know, where it imports most of its goods, but it has a big agricultural sector, and straw mm-hmm. is a natural byproduct of that. So it's this idea of like, could we do two things there, where we are like building from plant-based materials, but also we could be reducing our carbon footprint and our emissions through another way of bringing circularity into it. So there's a lot of synergies there. So that's one.
And what's your opinion on printing buildings?
I don't really understand it. I understand. I think it sounds very good, and my colleague Kevin probably would have a better answer on this. I think it's interesting to try and innovate new solutions, and if it aligns with the kind of green transition in terms of sequestering carbon and is cost effective, then it could be part of that. For me personally, I find it, I think it's, we already have this, a lot of the solutions there, we just need to scale them up. And I think this one maybe isn't at the scalability level yet to, you know, we have to reduce our carbon dramatically by 2030. Mm-hmm. And I personally don't see how that is going to be how it will get us there right now. It might in the future, maybe we get better at it, but I think right now we need to focus on plant-based materials, you know, localized production, you know, thinking in those ways.
I think something that often gets missed in this, and James can correct me if I'm wrong again, I'm the non-architect here.
You are an architect, Tom.
Okay. is when it comes to materiality or the physical presence of the building, what new materials, what new technologies can be created. I think something that I hear rarely is what materials mean for clients, which after all, we build for clients and others. And there is that question of, are clients willing to accept something which it might be the new best thing right now, but it might not be in future, or it's not tested, you know? And that's really important when we talk about printing or anything else. Like, what does it mean for a client, or who, it doesn't have to be just the client, it could be for everyone else that's involved in the building process. And so there are the soft skills around the hardware of materials that need to be considered in all of this as well, I'd say.
And maybe one other thing that's kind of also getting missed a little bit is, especially, and this is a very like Western perspective, you know, speaking from like, you know, Ireland, and we need to reuse our existing building stock a lot better, and we need to take a lot of the principles of don't, like the assumption that we just demolish everything and start fresh needs to go. And I think there needs to be a lot more rigor in when we are designing buildings, especially in existing urban environments, of the idea of adaptive reuse. I think especially for public sector organizations, because a lot of the time buildings are knocked down because it's seen as the, like, quote, riskier option, because when you're building with an existing building, you don't know necessarily everything that's in there. But I do think there needs to be a concerted effort by architects to, and the architecture education system, to retrofit as much as possible, because it does a couple of things. You know, it locks in the embodied carbon of the existing structure. You know, it's quicker, especially, probably not the same for you based in Germany, but Ireland's in the midst of a housing crisis. And our government's basically set these really high targets to build loads of houses. And it just says build. And there's also a dereliction crisis in Ireland at the same time. So we have this like strange thing in our head where we can walk into our empty town centers with all these empty buildings everywhere and say, there's nowhere to live, but there's loads of empty buildings. There's nowhere to live, but there's loads of empty buildings. And I think we need to join that and think, right, how do we do adaptive reuse quickly? And, you know, fix two problems, you know, at the same time. So some of the materials might be just the existing built fabric as a material.
Mm-hmm. Do you also make cuts in your private lives in terms of climate crisis, or just work related?
In cuts, what do you mean cuts?
Cuts in terms of not flying to Ibiza for the holidays, or
in terms of flying, it is
not buying plastic in the grocery market.
I guess I think for everyone, it's I try as best to practice what I preach, but we live in a kind of culture and a consumption kind of world where we're all hypocrites. And it is tricky. With one, for example, my partner's Swedish, so that has baked in kind of some flights there and again to go and see family and stuff. But we do try as best as we can to take, you know, the kind of, you know, boats or different kind of public transport options. But yeah, I guess in terms of maybe for me personally, I have very I don't really buy that many things. I try and when in our company, I maybe get back to ACT, our kind of policy of how we try and structure the company is, like, for example, all our software we buy second, our software, sorry, our hardware we buy secondhand. You know, we always look for if we can buy secondhand first before we make a new purchase, and that's been a great thing, especially from the IT background of it.
I'm smiling because in some ways I think we probably have reduced our travel just because there's so much time when you're running a business for running the business rather than for holidays and, mm-hmm. and such. But I've never been to Ibiza, but right now I think it's if I'm going anywhere, it's Ireland, back to Ireland for work.
Okay, that's good. In terms of clothing, are you someone that has to change every week, goes to H&M, Zara, buys a new shirt for €5, or do you keep your clothes and you fix it?
I have a how would you say, like a clothing style similar to Bart Simpson, where I pretty much have, I go every couple of years, buy a set of black and white or grey t-shirts and then just wear the same things. I try and dress, I big into climbing, and I have like climbing pants, which can get away with going to work, climbing a mountain, or, you know, I have multifunctional clothing, so I don't have that much. So yeah.
That's good.
My advantage is I hate shopping. I hate going into shops and having to make decisions in hot, sweaty, crowded places. So that's the last thing I want to do at the end of a week.
Good. If we look into the future, can you draw me a picture? How do you imagine the future living and working place? Like 50 years from now.
The relationship between living spaces?
How do you live and how do you work? Or is it combined and there are no offices existing anymore and you can just work from everywhere? How do you imagine it?
I think that...
Or we don't work at all anymore because AI is working for us.
Yeah, that is, I guess that would be the dream. Let's say AI isn't the dream and it just, but it's also not a nightmare and it just improves some people's lives and everyone's a little bit. I think living and working, I think that thing of purpose again is people always want purpose. And I don't think just holiday after holiday is people get bored.
Yeah,
so I think... I think that we'll always work. It's just that I think we'll work on things that we care more or most about. Whether we work remotely or not, there's always going to be people, and I think all of us want to some extent to work with, see people face to face as well. So I think it's going to be a lot more hybrid. That would be my guess.
And how many people will lose their jobs in terms of artificial intelligence? And how many, in your opinion, what kind of new jobs will be created then? Since they always say they will create new jobs. What new jobs then? I don't think that a bus driver can become an IT specialist.
After
2 weeks of schooling.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I think... Like I've read a lot of Yuval Harari's, Sapiens, and then the present and the looking forward. I think maybe even less than 50 years, I think, like, for example, our generation, even that are working, are going to have to learn how to upskill multiple times through their career. Because I think artificial intelligence will not just go after like the blue collar jobs, but the white collar jobs, but I don't necessarily fear it. I think there's a kind of, humans, I think, naturally kind of always say, oh, and this is going to be really bad, and then all this bad stuff's going to happen. I think Keynes, for example, the economist, Maynard Keynes, talked about this in the 50s, thinking that we're all going to work 15-hour weeks and humanity's greatest threat would be boredom. And it turned out that by that time, we were actually working more than ever. I think the human condition means that we are always searching for purpose, and I think we find purpose through work, but it might be that the nature of work becomes more fulfilling. So that might be it. I don't think necessarily we're working any less per se. I think we'll be working maybe towards different things, hopefully. And I think maybe the principles of circularity and regenerative design and principles of economy might be just second nature to us. We might actually look back at this period and laugh, in some ways that we didn't get our act together soon enough.
For example, in an architecture office, there's a lot of repetitive work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use AI, you don't need those people anymore. And then there's just one creative head left.
Mm-hmm. So
what do the other people do?
So I remember I used to work at an engineering company consultancy called Bureau Happold. And I used to sit next to the team itself was called something like computational analytics. And their whole purpose was to create software that could help all the other engineers do their work. And there was a little bit of mistrust from teams about, are they going to replace us? But I think they had a really good way of explaining it, is what software does, what technology should do, and often does. I think we can probably name, we're talking AI now, but we should also consider all the other software that we currently have that does what I'm about to explain, is it frees up all those things that could be taken over by machines to allow you, the human, to do what you do best. You know, clicking on things endlessly isn't something that really I think a human should do. For the engineering company, actually, in many ways, they were wasting good human intelligence because they were asking them to do really mundane stuff that shouldn't really be done. And actually what they really wanted and needed is those people to use their brains for things that machines can't do. Even with ChatGPT, et cetera, there's certain things that, as amazing as that is, it can't do as well. And I don't think we'll ever get to the point, I mean, sure, maybe we will get to the point where we can totally replace people, but I think it's always so far been about, or mainly about using people in the best way, or allowing them to use their brains in the best way.
Yeah, and maybe one other thing is maybe what I talked previously about was the idea that we kind of got fixated on like what the building, how it operates in the first way of challenging carbon or the green, you know, agenda. Then we start thinking about what it's built of. Maybe the AI will unlock for architecture and designers the opportunity to discuss the brief, like what's its impact. So we can actually, you know, spend less time doing door schedules, as much as I love doing door schedules. You know,
really?
More, no, I don't. I did them. But for example, like my first job, I drew lots of window schedules, door schedules. Now that's just done automatically in Revit. Great. I can now spend more time doing another aspect of the design, which is probably more impactful. So I just think maybe AI, the element of AI will just mean that the architect maybe has to spend less time, his or her time, on the quote unquote mundane tasks, which are important. Some people really like doing window schedules. No, not gonna anyone who loves doing that. But
yeah, maybe, if you like to arrive in the office and turn your head off for the next 8 hours.
Yeah, that's sometimes really, really fun to do, and like, you know, I get into making physical models again in the office and stuff. But it's like, I think this idea of what we're talking about with the briefs is really interesting. Like the idea of really interrogating that time, because those decisions in the first few weeks of a project have the biggest impact and ramifications. Like if you read the new RIBAs, you know, Designing for a Climate Emergency, it shows the kind of principle of basically like front loading the thinking, because, you know, you have the most impact at the start. So we need to have design processes that focus right into that, on that phase.
My personal favorite question would be how looks your perfect world? If you could draw me a picture, how do you live in your perfect little world? How do the houses look like? What do you work? How are the people together?
Oh, that is a good question, but you can't throw that on just like that. I think it's a really natural thing for an architect to, and that's why I like architects, to be able to like propose what the future looks like. I think it's one where you don't get everything you want. You have to compromise. And so what's great for me may look entirely different from someone else. That's why I like, when I can, traveling, because you see cities as they were designed for completely different cultures. And that is just so exciting for me. So I like maybe not how everything is right now, but, you know, to continue that people design places for their own values and to discover them as well. So I don't want everything in my image or one vision that I see, but to be able to.
You don't have a dream house?
Oh, do I have a dream house? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it all centers. Yeah. Oh, but that's a different question. So it all centers around the kitchen. always in the kitchen. It has an entrance or straight into the garden as well for barbecues. So again, more cooking, but this time outside, probably somewhere in London. But that would be hopefully my dream.
So you have a big garden to do barbecues and a big centered kitchen in London.
Said dream house. You didn't say real house. And given that right now Sadiq Khan, mayor of London, is saying that the average rent is around $2,500 per month, a lot will have to change in 50 years.
Okay, so thank you very much for the interview. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much for your time, Therese. And it has been really good to be part of your great podcast. And I hope we came across well in terms of what we're trying to do. And also, can I do a little plug? We're hiring. We're looking for interns. Can I do that? I've already done it. Oops, sorry. We're looking for architectural interns. If anybody's interested, please email work@act-studio.com. That would be great.
This was this week's episode. We really hope you liked it as much as we did. If you have comments, suggestions, critique, please let us know. And till next time on What's Next. Ciao, ciao.